Really born in April of 1948, but I dropped the 4, converted it to a 3, and that made me 10 years older, or 26 years old. I walked around applying for the same type of work. People gave me a little more money, a few more hours, but even then it was difficult to make ends meet. One of the few things I had left went home with was a checkbook. My father had opened a checking account for me at a small community bank in Mount Vernon, New York. I had a little money in the account, so every so often I'd write a check to supplement my income. $10, $20, funds were there, checks were good. But it was my friends, my peers, who would constantly say to me, "You know, you're the only guy I know walks into a bank in the middle of Manhattan. You have no account there. You don't know a soul. You talk to somebody behind a desk, and they okay your check." Oh, well, my checks are good. If I walked in that bank, they wouldn't touch my check. You walk in, they don't bat an eye. Now, years later, reporters would write and speculate that that was my upbringing, mannerisms, dress, appearance, speech, whatever it was very easy to do. So, consequently, when the money ran out, I kept writing those checks. Of course, the checks started to bounce. Police were looking for me as a runaway. I thought maybe it was a good time to start thinking about leaving New York City. But I was quite apprehensive about going to Chicago, Miami, wondered if they'd cash a New York check on a New York driver's license in Miami as quickly as they did in Manhattan. I was walking up 42nd Street one afternoon about 5 o'clock in the evening, 16 years old, pondering all of these things, when I started to approach the front door of an old hotel that used to be there called the Commodore Hotel, now the Grand Hyatt. Just as I was about to get to the front door of the hotel, out stepped an Eastern Airline flight crew onto the sidewalk. Couldn't help but notice the captain, the co-pilot, the flight engineer, about 3 or 4 flight attendants dragging their bags to the curb to load them in a van to take them to the airport. As they loaded the van, I thought to myself, that's it. If I could pose as a pilot, I could travel all over the world for free. I probably could get just about anybody anywhere to cash a check for me. So I walked up the street a little further to 42nd and Park. I went to cross over. I heard a huge helicopter, so I looked up, and there was New York Airways landing on the roof of the Pan Am building. Pan Am, the nation's flag carrier, the airline that flew around the world. I thought, what a perfect airline to use. So the next day, I placed a phone call to the executive corporate offices of Pan Am. When the switchboard was ringing, I had absolutely no idea what I was going to say. When they answered, "Pan American Airlines, can I help you?" "Yes, ma'am." "I'd like to speak to somebody in the purchasing department." "Purchasing?" "One moment." And a clerk came on and said, "Yes, sir, maybe you can help me. My name is John Black. I'm a co-pilot with the company, based out of San Francisco. Been with the company about 7 years. Never had anything like this come up before." "Oh, what's the problem?" "Well, we flew a trip in here yesterday. We're going out today. Yesterday, I sent my uniform out through the hotel to have it dry cleaned. Now the hotel and the cleaner say they can't find it. Here I am with a flight in about 4 hours. New uniform. Don't you have a spare uniform?" "Certainly, back home in San Francisco, but I never get it here in time for my flight." "Do you understand that this will cost you the price of a uniform, not the company?" "I understand. Hold on, I'll be right back." And he came back and said, "My supervisor says you need to go down to the well-built uniform company on Fifth Avenue. They're our supplier. I'll call them and tell them you're on the way." Well, that's exactly what I wanted to know, so I went down to the well-built uniform company. Little fellow, Mr. Rosen, fitted me out in the uniform. Back then they were gabardine, the black uniform, the 3 gold stripes on the arm, the gray hair. I certainly looked old enough to be the pilot. When he was all done, I said, "How much do I owe you?" "Well, the uniform's $286. I said, "No problem, I'll write you a check." "No, no, we can't take any checks." "Oh, well then I'll just pay you cash." "Oh, no, we can't accept cash." "You need to fill out this computer card. Then in these boxes, put your employee number. And we bill this back under uniform allowance. Comes out of your next Pan Am paycheck." "Well, that's even better. Go ahead and do that." New York had 2 airports, LaGuardia and Kennedy. LaGuardia was 20 minutes from New York. Kennedy was 50. So naturally, LaGuardia being the closer of the two, that's where I went. Spent most of the morning walking around LaGuardia in the uniform, trying to figure out, now that I had the uniform, how the hell do you get on these planes? Well, I got a little hungry about lunchtime, so I walked in the luncheonette, sat down at the counter on the stool, and ordered a sandwich. Moments later, a TWA crew walked in. The flight attendant sat in the booth, but the pilots up at the counter on either side of me, captain right next to me. Now, back before deregulation of the airlines, airline people thought of themselves as just one big family. They didn't hesitate a moment to talk to each other, and the captain kind of leaned over. Hey, young man, how's Pan Am doing?
Doing just fine, Captain.
I mean, what's Pan Am doing out here at LaGuardia? Pan Am doesn't fly into LaGuardia. They only fly into Kennedy. Well, I picked up on that right away. Yeah, we came in at Kennedy, had a short layover, came over to visit some friends of mine. Matter of fact, on my way back to Kennedy now. So tell me, young man, what type of equipment are you on? Now, airline people have a lot of jargon for things, and one of them is they never call a plane or an aircraft. They call it equipment. And what type of equipment you're on meant what type of plane do you fly? Back then, a DC-8, a 707. Of course, I didn't know that, and I thought, what type of equipment am I on? Only equipment I'm on is a stool. They must mean what type of equipment is on the planes I fly. So I thought, well, they have the wings, they have the engine. They always had a sticker on the engine, who manufactured the engine. So I said, yes, General Electric. All three pilots kind of just stopped eating, leaned over. Captain said, oh, really? What do you fly, washing machines? I knew I said the wrong thing. Out the door I went. Everybody had an airline ID card, plastic, laminated card, much like a driver's license today. Yet without the ID card, the uniform was worthless. I went back to Manhattan pretty discouraged, thinking, where would I come up with a Pan American airline corporate ID? I was sitting in a hotel room. I noticed a big, thick Manhattan Yellow Pages on the dresser, so I pulled them down on the bed, flipped them open, and looked under the word identification. There were three or four pages of companies who made convention badges, metal badges, plastic badges, police badges, fire badges. I started to call around, and finally one company said, listen, most of those airline IDs manufactured by Polaroid, 3M Company, need to call one of them. Finally got the 3M Company on the phone in Manhattan. Yeah, we manufacture Pan Am's identification system along with a number of other carriers. How come? So I tell you, I'm a purchasing officer for a major U.S. carrier. I'm in New York just for the day. We're getting ready to expand our routes, hire a lot of new employees, go to a formal ID. We're very impressed with this Pan Am format. Wondered if I came by your office this afternoon briefly, we could discuss quantity and price. By all means, come on by. So I went by dressed in a suit, and the sales rep opened the book. Yeah, we do United, Delta, Eastern, Pan Am. Pan Am, we like this format. Wonder if you might have a sample I could bring back. Sure, I'll be right back. And he brought me back a 5x7 glossy piece of paper with a picture of an ID card blown up in the middle of it, someone else's picture in the picture, John Doe for a name, and in bold red ink across the front, this is a sample only. I said, no, I'm afraid this won't do. You know, I need to bring back an actual physical card. And by the way, what is all this equipment on the floor? Oh, now, we don't just sell this card. We sell the system, camera, laminator. I see. So we'd have to buy all of this. Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, since we have to buy it all, why don't you just demonstrate it works and use me? Fine. Have a seat right here. Took my picture, made up the card, and I was going down the elevator studying the card, had a blue border across the top, about a quarter of an inch in Pan Am's color blue, but not a single thing on the card said Pan Am. No logo, no insignia, no company name. This was a plastic card like a credit card. You couldn't type on it, you couldn't write on it, couldn't print on it. Discouraged, I put it in my pocket, headed back to the hotel. As I was walking back, I noticed I had passed a hobby shop, so I turned around and walked back. Excuse me, sir, I see you sell a lot of models here. You sell models of commercial jetliners? Sure, over there. And I bought a model of a Pan Am 707 cargo jet for about $2.40, took it back to my room, opened the box, threw all the parts out, but there at the bottom of the box was a sheet of decals that went on the model. And when soaked in a glass of water, the little Pan Am logo, the blue globe that would have went on the tail of the plastic plane, went perfect up at the top of the plastic card. And the word Pan Am and the special styling of graphics that would have went on the fuselage went perfect across the top of the card, and the clear decal on the laminated plastic made a beautiful identification card. Pan Am says they estimate that between the ages of 16 and 18, I flew more than 1 million miles for free, boarded more than 250 commercial aircraft in more than 26 countries. Pan Am says, keep in mind that though Frank Abagnale did in fact pose as one of our pilots, he never once stepped on board one of our aircraft. That's true. I never flew on Pan Am because I was afraid someone might say to me, you know, I'm based in San Francisco, been out there 21 years. I don't recall ever meeting you before. Or someone might say, you know, your ID card, not exactly like my ID card. So instead, I flew on everyone else. If I wanted to go somewhere, I literally just walked out to the airport, looked up on the board, United Flight 800 to Chicago. Then I went downstairs to the door marked United Operations and walked in. The operations clerk, "Hey, Pan Am, what can we do for you?" "I was wondering if the jump seat's open on 800. I need to deadhead to Chicago." "Jump seat, open this evening. I'd like to get a pink slip pass." And I'd give him my ID, he'd write me out a pass. I'd walk out, hand it to the flight attendant. She'd open the door to the cockpit, and I'd step in. They had a captain, a co-pilot, a flight engineer in a seat behind the captain called the jump seat, where pilots deadhead on company time. And because pilots love to talk shop, once you picked up that jargon, it was the same conversation over and over and over. So I just step on board, Jim, Bob Davis, be riding in Chicago. On the taxi out, always the same question. "So, Bob, how long you been with Pan Am?" "Been flying about 7 years." "What position you fly?" "A right seat," which is airline terminology for a co-pilot. "What type of equipment are you on?" Had that one down. Perfect. Matter of fact, whatever they flew, I didn't fly, so I had no problems with that. We'd arrive in Chicago, I'd go by the Pan Am ticket counter, but just enough to get the attention of the passenger service rep. "Sir, it help you?" "Excuse me, where do we lay over here?" "The dead-headed trip for somebody got ill, never laid over in Chicago." "Oh, yeah, so we was at Parma House Hilton, downtown, catch the crew bus, lower level, door 3A. I'd go down the Parma House Hilton, walk in, and on the corner of the registration desk was a little sign that said, "Airline Cruise." That was a three-ring binder. You signed in, referenced your flight number, showed your ID, they'd give me a key. I'd stay 2 or 3 days, and Pan Am would be direct billed for my room and my meals. I also could cash a personal check up at the front desk because the airline had a contract with the hotel, and as a courtesy, they'd cash your check up to $100. But then I found out that every airline honors every other airline, employee's personal check, a reciprocal agreement still practiced today in 2012, so that a Delta flight attendant at the Austin airport can walk over to the American ticket counter, show her Delta ID, and cash a personal check up to $100, and vice versa. Of course, when I found that out, I'd go out to JFK, LAX, only I'd go to everybody, Northeast, National, KLM, Air France. It would take me a good 8 hours, stopping at every counter in every building. By the time I got all the way around the other end of the airport, at least 8 hours had gone by, and what do you have in 8 hours? Shift change, new people, so I'd go all the way back around the other way. I made a great deal of money. The only reason I quit at 18 is the FBI issued a John Doe warrant for interstate transportation of fraudulent checks, a federal offense. The John Doe warrant meant the FBI didn't know my identity. In the warrant, the FBI said, based on interviews with people I had contact with, I was approximately 30 years old. I was 18, had a great deal of money, so I hung the uniform up and moved to Atlanta, Georgia. In Atlanta, I moved into a very swank singles complex that had just been built there called the Riverbend Apartments. On the application for the lease, there were a lot of questions for a teenage boy. One was occupation. I began to write down airline pilot, but the next question said employed by, supervisor's name, telephone contact. I thought to myself, I'll need to come up with something that would be impossible to check out, yet something that would justify why I drive an expensive car, wear expensive clothes, don't work much. So I wrote down the word doctor. First thing came to my mind, nothing else. But I had a very inquisitive apartment manager. "Oh, I see here you're a doctor." "Yes, ma'am." "What type of doctor are you?" "Well, I'm a medical doctor. However, I'm not practicing medicine right now. I left my practice out in Los Angeles to come to Atlanta to invest in some real estate I have. So I won't be practicing for a while." "How interesting. Well, tell me, what type of medical doctor are you?" And I figured, being a singles complex, pediatrician would be pretty safe. So I moved in, Dr. Frank Williams, pediatrician. Now, everybody called me Doc, always the typical questions at the pool. "So, Doc, where'd you go to medical school?" "Columbia University, New York." "Where'd you serve your internship?" "The Harbor Children's Hospital, out in L.A. Once in a while, when the guys would come by, "Hey, Paul." "Hey, Doc, look at my leg. I don't know what I did to it. Look at this." "Paul, I can't examine your leg. You need to go to your own doctor, have him look at that." When the girls came by, I always gave them a thorough examination, sent them on their way. I was young, but not stupid. I was living there for about 2 or 3 months. Everything was going great. One afternoon, there was a knock on the door. A very distinguished gentleman, mid-50s, standing there. "Is I going to help you?" "You are Dr. Williams?" "Yes." "My name's Gordon. Just moved in the apartment down below. Wanted to come up and introduce myself. Our new neighbor. Come on in." "Well, I understand that you're a pediatrician." "Yes, I'm the chief resident pediatrician of the county hospital up the street." Dr. Gordon was going through a divorce, just separated from his wife. He was very upset, very lonely. Every day on the way to the pool, out to the tennis court, out to the car, he'd stop you. And after a minute or two about the weather, he'd start speaking medical terminology. Not being able to converse with him, I in turn would cut him short. But I knew eventually he'd get suspicious. Determined not to move, every day I went to Emory University's medical library. Every day I read the daily journals from Johns Hopkins, the Mayo Clinic. Every day I took a certain part of the journal, memorized it to detail, and every night when Dr. Gordon pulled in his parking slot, and this is without exaggeration, every night I was sitting on his doorstep. Hey, Doc, hear about this new theory they're using up at Mayo? What is it tonight? Aggravated, he'd go into his apartment. I'd follow him in. If he went to his bedroom to get undressed, I'd go in his bedroom, sit on the edge of the bed. Be in the kitchen, I'd follow him back and forth. Go to the bathroom, I'd talk through the door. Pretty soon he'd come home. Hey, Doc, I don't have time to talk to you right now. I gotta go. Guys started to avoid me, which is exactly what I wanted. One afternoon, I received a phone call from the hospital administrator, who is not a physician, but the administrator of the hospital. Dr. Gordon suggested I give you a call. He said you'd be more than happy to help us out. What's the problem? On the midnight day shift, I have a doctor supervising a number of interns, nurses on that ship. He's just been notified of a death in his family. He's turning to the West Coast tomorrow for about 2 weeks. A Georgia law requires the house doctor on duty be a full practitioner or a specialist. Dr. Gordon suggested that you had a great deal of free time. You'd be more than happy to cover the ship in an administrative capacity. There's no way I could do that. Why not? Well, I'm not licensed to practice medicine in the state of Georgia, just the state of California where I hold my residency. All the red tape for 2 weeks? No red tape. We'll bring it before the Medical Review Board tomorrow morning. They'll issue a temporary certificate. You can start tomorrow night. Now, being one who hates to pass up a challenge, I couldn't help but give it a shot. So I went up to the hospital. During my entire stay there, no one ever doubted for a second that I was not the doctor, and I left when the doctor returned. I did pass the bar in the state of Louisiana, not in 2 weeks as the movie implies, but in 2 months by taking the two-month prep course for the bar. Actually, at the time, Louisiana did not require a law degree to take the bar. Louisiana practiced their law under the French Napoleonic Criminal Code of Procedure. I took the bar, passed the bar, and went to work for then-Attorney General P.F. Grimion in the Civil Division of the State Court, where I spent about a year, only on my own, no one the wiser. I resigned and left. A lot of people say, you know, it's not so much the people you impersonated as a teenage boy as it is the crimes you perpetrated as a teenage boy. Well, I did a lot of things that had just never been done before, so they got a lot of attention. I was walking down a Chicago street one day counting five $20 bills in my pocket. As I was counting them, I passed the front door of a bank. There was a sign in the window that said, open a checking account. So I thought to myself, I'll go in this bank, open a checking account with this $100. I'll give him this phony Pan Am ID for identification. In 2 weeks, this bank will mail me 200 printed checks in a box with this name and with this ID. I'll cash them anywhere. So I walked in, opened the account. New accounts person came back. So here's a receipt for your $100. These are some temporary checks. We'll be mailing you your printed checks in about 10 days. Now, being young, I was always inquisitive. So I noticed you didn't give me any deposit slips. No, sir, they come from the check printer. Be in the back of your checkbook, printing your name, your address, your account number, and get them in about 10 days. I see. I was just curious, you know, if I wished to make a deposit tomorrow or next week. Not a problem. You see the table in the lobby? Has all the forms on it? Just go over there and help yourself to a blank deposit slip. In this box, just write your account number in it. I assigned you. Use those till you get your printed one. So I walked over and took a big stack of them off the shelf. Nobody cared. Went back to my hotel. But I couldn't sleep. I kept staring at them on the dresser. So the next morning, I went out and bought what was called the Burroughs 1000 Magnetic Encoder. Looked like a big green calculating machine. And I magnetically encoded my account number the bank had assigned to me the day before on the bottom of every one of these blanks. I then went back to the bank, put them on the shelf in the lobby, and everyone who came in put their check in my account. I was at the Logan Airport in Boston. I was trying to catch a flight. It was about 11:45 at night. I ran out to the airport. The whole airport was closing down. Rented cars, gift shops, ticket counters. I walked up to the ticket counter. Excuse me, you're closing the airport? Actually, the airport lies in the heart of the city. Comes under the government's noise abatement control program. We have no jet operations after midnight. Next flight out is at 6:30 in the morning. So I sat down wondering what to do. I noticed they were all sticking their cash and receipts in these big bank bags. Then they'd zip them closed, lock them, put them under their arm, walk around the counter and down the hall to the bank that was in the terminal. They'd stick their key in the night box, open it, drop the bag down the chute, make sure it went all the way down, closed it, locked it. One right after the other, Hertz, Avis, Delta, Eastern, Dobbs House, dropping the bag. I didn't give this a lot of thought, but I came back to the airport the next night about 11:45. I had rented a bank guard uniform from a costume store in Boston, hung a beautiful sign over the night box, said, "Night box out of order. Please leave all deposits with guard on duty." Everyone did. I was a nervous one sitting there going, "How the hell can a box be out of order? I mean, that's like a mailbox without an order sign." Of course, like any criminal, sooner or later you get caught, and I was no exception to that rule. I was actually arrested just once in my life at the age of 21 by the French police in a small town in southern France called Montpellier. The French police arresting me on an Interpol warrant issued by the Swedish police, who were looking for me for forgery. When the French government took me into custody on the Swedish warrant, they soon realized I'd forged checks all over France, and they refused to honor the warrant from Sweden. They later convicted me of forgery and sent me to French prison. I served my time in a place called the Maison d'Arrêt, the house of arrest, in a small town in southern France called Perpignan. Steven Spielberg told Barbara Walters, "It was extremely important to me to go back to that prison, to the exact cell Frank was in, and reconstruct it according to the logbooks during his stay there," which he said was a blanket on the floor, a hole in the floor to go to the bathroom, no plumbing, no electricity. He said, "Amazingly, the book shows that I entered the prison at 198 pounds and left the prison at 109 pounds. When my sentence was over in France, I was extradited to Sweden. I was later convicted in Sweden of forgery and sent to a Swedish penitentiary in Malmö, Sweden. When my prison term was up in Sweden, federal authorities took custody of me and returned me to the United States. Eventually, a United States federal judge sentenced me to 12 years in federal prison. I served 4 of those 12 years at a federal prison in Virginia. When I was 26 years old, the government offered to take me out of prison on the condition I go to work for an agency of the government for the remainder of my sentence or until my parole had been satisfactorily completed. I agreed and was released. This year I'm celebrating 36 years at the FBI, where I've worked and work today and for the past 36 years. I make my home actually in Charleston, South Carolina, where I live with my wife of 35 years and my 3 sons. I commute up and down the coast to Washington each week. My youngest son is 28. He graduated from the University of Beijing in China. He went on to get his master's there. He reads, writes, and speaks Chinese fluently. He works for an American company that makes mobile games for mobile telephones in China. My middle son graduated from University of Nevada in Las Vegas. His degree was in hotel administration. My wife owns a business in South Carolina. He manages that business for her. My oldest boy, 32 now, graduated from the University of Kansas at KU. He went on to Loyola School of Law in Chicago to get his law degree, passed the bar in Illinois, went on to make his dad very, very proud. He's an FBI agent in our counterintelligence unit in Baltimore, Maryland. As many of you know, I had nothing to do with the film because the Bureau did not allow my participation in the film, nor the acceptance of any money or royalties from books, movies, television, or Broadway plays. So I watched it from afar, and there was a great deal of apprehension in the beginning. But in the end, my family and I felt that Steven Spielberg went out of his way not to glorify the things I did, but to simply tell the story about what I did. In the one-hour special about the making of Catch Me If You Can by Barbara Walters, he said to her in the closing, "I did not immortalize Frank Abagnale on film because of what he did 40 years ago as a teenage boy. I actually chose to immortalize him on film because of what he's done for his country for more than 30 years." Unquote. In the end, my family and I were very pleased by the result of the film. Now, needless to say, I get hundreds of emails back in Washington. I had a bunch of them today, which I came from there this morning. I'm heading back there in just a little while, because I know that it must have ran on TV last night. Every time I get those emails, and I get somebody tells me, "Well, Catch Me If You Can was on television last night." And the interesting thing is the emails come from people as young as 8 years old to people as old as 80. And they're writing, not looking for a response, they just feel they need to make a statement. Some write and say, "You know, you were brilliant. You were an absolute genius. I was neither. I was actually just a child. Had I been brilliant, had I been a genius, I don't know that I would have found it necessary to break the law in order to just simply survive. And while I know that people are fascinated by what I did 40 years ago as a teenage boy, I've always looked upon what I did as something that was immoral, illegal, unethical, and a burden I live with every day of my life and will until my death. There are many who write and say, well, you know, you were certainly gifted. That I was. I was one of those few children that got to grow up in the world with a daddy. Now, the world is full of fathers. But there are very few men worthy of being called daddy by their child. I had a daddy who loved his children more than he loved life itself. Steven Spielberg would say that the more I researched Frank's youth without the use of Frank, I couldn't help but bring his father into the film through the likes of Christopher Walken. My father was a man who had four children, three boys and a daughter. Every night at bedtime, he'd walk into your room. He was 6'3". He would drop down on one knee, kiss you on the cheek, pull the cover up, and he'd put his lip up on your earlobe and he'd whisper into your ear, I love you. I love you very much. He never missed a night. As I grew older, I sometimes fell asleep before he got home, but I always woke up the next morning, knew he had been by my bedside. Years later, my older brother joined me in my room. He was 6'4 in the Marine Corps. He played semi-pro football for Buffalo, but when he came home on leave, my father would walk around to his bed, hug him, kiss him, whisper in his ear he loved him. When I was 16 years old, I was just a child. All 16-year-olds are just children. Much as we like them to be adults, they're just children. And like all children, they need their mother, and they need their father. All children need their mother and their father. All children are entitled to their mother and their father. And though it is not popular to say so, divorce is a very devastating thing for a child to deal with and then have to deal with the rest of their natural life. For me, a complete stranger said I had to choose one parent over the other. There was no choice, so I ran. How could I tell you that my life was glamorous? I cried myself to sleep till I was 19 years old. I spent every birthday, Christmas, Mother's Day, Father's Day in a hotel room by myself. When I was sick alone. There was no one to take care of me. My only friends were peers, 10 years older than me, that believed me to be their peer. And I never got to go to a senior prom, high school football game, or even share a relationship with someone my own age. I grew up very quickly. I always knew I'd get caught. Only a fool would think otherwise. The law sometimes sleeps, but the law never dies. It was just a matter of time. I was caught. I went to some very bad places. My boys have grown up asking their mother, why is it that Dad wakes up in the middle of the night and goes down the TV room because he doesn't turn the TV on? He just sits there all night because there are things you can't forget, things you're not meant to forget. While I was sitting in that pitch black cell, my father, 57, was climbing the subway stairs in New York. He was in great physical shape, in great health. He just happened to trip on a step. He reached his arm out to break his fall, but he slipped. He hit his head on the railing. He landed at the bottom of the step. He was dead. I didn't know he was dead. I was sitting in the cell thinking about how much I couldn't wait to see him, hold him, hug him, kiss him, tell him how sorry I was. But I never got the opportunity to do that. I was very fortunate because I was brought up in a great country that gives everyone a second chance. I owe my country 800 times more than I could ever possibly repay it for these past 36 years. That is why I'm at the FBI today, 26 years beyond my legal obligation to do so. I have turned down three pardons from three sitting presidents of the United States because I do not believe, nor will I ever believe, that a piece of paper will excuse my actions, that only in the end my actions will. 35 years ago, on an undercover assignment not far from here, in Houston, Texas, I met my wife. When the assignment was over, I broke protocol to tell her who I really was. Didn't have a dime to my name. I eventually asked her to marry me. Against the wishes of her parents, she did. Now, I could sit up here and give you a story that I was born again. I could tell you that prison rehabilitated me, or I guess I could take a cheap shot and just tell you that I was some kid who made some mistakes and grew up. But the truth is, God gave me a wife. She gave me three beautiful children. She gave me a family, and she changed my life. She, and she alone. Everything I have, everything I've achieved, is because of the love of a woman and the respect three boys have for their father, something I would never, ever jeopardize. There comes a time in all of our lifetimes that we grow older and we have children. And as every parent in this room knows, whether your child is 3 months old or 32 years old, when you lay your head on a pillow at night, no matter where that pillow is, and you're just about to close your eyes, the last thing you think about, the last thing you worry about, are your children. So if you still have your mother, you still have your father, you give them a hug, you give them a kiss, while you can. And to those men in the audience, both young and old, I would remind you what it truly is to actually be a man. It has nothing to do with money, achievements, skills, accomplishments, degrees, professions, positions. A real man loves his wife. A real man is faithful to his wife. And a real man next to God and his country put his wife and his children as the most important thing in his life. Steven Spielberg made a wonderful film, but I've done nothing greater, nothing more rewarding, nothing more worthwhile, nothing that's brought me more peace, more joy, more happiness, or calm in my life than simply being a good husband, a good father, and what I strive to be every day of my life, a great daddy. It's been a pleasure. God bless you, and thanks for coming today. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. 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 That means a lot coming from some extremely creative and intelligent people. I thank you very much. I will take questions. The questions can be anything you like about the movie, crime, identity theft, or anything of that nature.
Put your hashtag up.
Okay. Anyone have a question for us?
Folks, right. Please come to the aisle for your Q&A.
Thank you. Very moving. I very much appreciated it.
Thank you.
My question is that what you did in your life when you were a teenager, given today's environment with the internet and security, is it possible to do what you did today?
It is sad to say that what I did 40 years ago is now 4,000 times easier to do today than when I did it. Do please remember that technology breeds crime. It always has, and it always will. And a simple example is that 40 years ago, for me to just create a check, I needed a Heidelberg printing press. The press would just about fit in this room. It was $1 million, 90 feet long, 18 feet high, ladders on the side of it, required three journeyman operators to operate it, color separations, negatives, plates, typesetting, and chemicals. To eliminate the two other printers, I built scaffolding, as Steven Spielberg showed in the movie, onto the top of the press, so I could learn to operate that press by myself. Because I was just a teenage boy, I was able to run the length of that press and operate that press. Today, if I was creating that same check, I would simply open my laptop and pick a victim by just looking out. If my victim's Delta Airlines, then I would simply go to their website and capture their logo. I would diagram a check on my screen, put Delta's logo in full color up in the left-hand corner, put their corporate address in Atlanta, put a Delta jet taking off in the background of the check with their tail section, and write the words Delta, Delta, and step and repeat, and within 15 minutes I'd have a beautiful four-color check, 10 times prettier than the actual check Delta does use, and of course I would be able to go down to Office Depot, Staples, Office Max, buy the check paper that I need to print it on, and a color printer to print it out. The technology has made all of the things I did a lot easier. The only thing that I did that might be a little more difficult today would be posing as a pilot, only because when I did it, there was no terrorism, there were no hijackings, bomb scares, etc. That might be a little bit difficult today, but unfortunately, to make up an airline ID today with today's technology would be as like counting 1, 2, 3, would be a very simple task to do. So it is scary and quite unbelievable, but it would be a lot easier today than when I did it. Yes, sir.
Yes, well, I'm a husband and father, and I have to agree with your sentiments about the proudest aspect of my life. I did have a question. You mentioned being a child still when you were 16 and starting out, and children love play. Would you say that there was an aspect of play at all, or was it, you had mentioned it was about survival. Was there anything?
I truly believe that it was three stages. It started out simply as survival. I'm in New York City. I'm alone. How am I going to survive? So it started out being creative in order to survive. Then it became that people are chasing me. So how am I going to stay ahead of the people that are chasing me? And then the people chasing me became more of a game, because I was still just a teenager, about staying away from them and being one step ahead of them. And that became a game, to eventually, which led to my capture, which I always knew would happen. But I think it really came in those stages as I went along down the journey of doing those things.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hi. In the movie, when Leonardo DiCaprio escapes through the bathroom of the plane, did that really happen? And if so, that's really cool. How did that happen?
When I was asked to review the movie, because I saw it in the theater like everyone else, what was accurate and what wasn't, I thought he stayed very close to the story. What he did is he went back and got the three agents who you saw in the film. They were retired, all living. He brought them to the set. And the Bureau provided our information officer, who went to the set to make sure that they stayed accurate to the story. And Steven Spielberg has an enormous research team who did their research and went back to kids I went to school with and talked to kids that I went to elementary school with and high school. So looking at the film, there were very few things. One, I've come with three brothers and a sister. He said I was an only child. In real life, my mother never remarried. In the film, he wanted her to be remarried, and there was a little girl in the window at Christmas time. In real life, there was no contact between my father and myself, but he felt the audience needed to know the relationship between my father and myself, so he put Christopher Walken in the film and allowed me to go back and have conversation with him throughout the film. In real life, I escaped off the aircraft through the service area where they service the aircraft, through the kitchen and supplies, not through the toilet. I was desperate, but I wasn't that desperate to go through the toilet. And other than that, in the end of the movie, there was a scene where I went back to the FBI and then I walked away, put on a uniform, and thought about changing my mind. He has admitted many times that actually did not happen, but he felt he needed to establish with the audience that I had made up my mind to stick at it and stay with it. And other than that, I thought he stayed very close and accurate to the story. Leonardo DiCaprio did a wonderful job when I... when he finished Gangs in New York, you know, his hair was real long. He was 27, 28 years old. He's 6 foot tall. He looked all of that being 27, 28. So all I could think of is, how is this person, having seen Gangs in New York, going to portray a 15, 16-year-old boy? And he was unbelievable in what he did to portray that teenager throughout the film, starting out at 15, then going to 16, and going to 18, and then going to 20 throughout the length of the film. So I was blessed with an incredible actor who took the part, and took the part very seriously to play it to the best that he could, and it was great.
Just one more question.
Thanks.
Did you impersonate a substitute teacher? Because my mom's a teacher and laughs about it all, that she's like going to walk into a classroom and one of her kids is going to be impersonating her.
Yeah, I did substitute. As a matter of fact, I had kind of forgotten about that, so when my wife and I were watching the film, she said, "You never told me about this." I said, I kind of forgot all about that. Yeah.
Thank you.
That's fair. Absolutely.
It's really moving.
Thank you.
When you met your future wife in Houston, I'm curious how you told her about your past and what she thought about it.
That's very interesting. We were investigating an orphanage in Houston that had about 100 children in it. Most of the funding came from the government. The government was concerned that money was being misdirected out of there. When I went on an assignment, all the government would say to me is, there's an opening at this orphanage for a Master of Social Work in MSW. Here's your credentials. Go apply for the job. Because we didn't know who inside that system was behind it, or who might not be behind it. So I applied with three MSWs, Masters of Social Work, and they hired me. And I went to work there. My wife was writing, finishing her paper on her master's degree in child psychology, and she was working as an intern there. And so when I first met her, I dated her under this different name and, of course, had to have a story about I was from a different state and all my background. And I met her parents under this false identity of being this other person. And normally what would happen when an assignment was over and the case was over, I would just simply go into whoever my boss or supervisor was and say, I had a death in my family this morning. I have to return home. I'll be gone a few days. And he'd say, fine, you know, of course, just keep us contact with us and let us know. And then I'd call a couple of days later and say, I'm not coming back. I'm not able to return to work. A friend will come by and pick up my belonging, as an agent would go by and pick it up. When that came to this case, I took my wife to Memorial Park in Houston and parked and said to her, I need to tell you something. First of all, this is not my name. My real name is Frank Abagnale. Second, I'm not a Master of Social Work. I never even went to college. I work for the government. And I was on an undercover assignment. My assignment's over, and I need to leave. So she paused, and she said, so what you're telling me is that you're a government agent? And I said, not by choice. So then I had to tell her the rest of the story. Yes, sir.
It's a really strong message of having done something that you are consciously aware of was not good at the time, but it's led to a lot of great things for you. Do you ever think back, would you do it all again the same exact way?
Absolutely. Now, I was asked that question this morning. I did an interview at lunchtime with Ali Veshi from CNN, who I've been on with him a few times before about financial things. But he asked me, would I do that over again? And the honest to God truth is no. It was a very lonely, lonely life. It was, I gave up all my teenage years of being a teenager. I spent 5 years in prison, so being a young adult from 21 to 26, I gave away to being a life in prison. There were no friends, there were no people you could trust in. Everyone you met, no matter how nice you were to them, no matter how much you were giving them financially, money, some gifts, you were still deceiving them. And people do not like to be deceived, no matter what you do. And so it was not a great life, and a life that has a lot of regrets. And if I could live it all over again, even though I know all the success it's brought me and where it's brought me, I wouldn't want to have to go through that life again. I would have settled for a much simpler life. And it is a burden. People tell you that life is short. Life is not short. Life is very long. Someone in my generation will live to be in their 80s or 90s, and your generation into their hundreds. And when you make a mistake in life, you have to live with that mistake the rest of your life. The way you treat someone, the way you carry a relationship with someone, dishonesty with someone else, it doesn't bother you then, but as time goes by and you get older, all of those things come back to haunt you, and they stay with you for the rest of your life. So it was a burden I took upon myself that I will never get rid of. There are always going to be people who criticize me for what I did, no matter how good I may have turned it around. So you were always living with the fact that there's that former con man, there's that ex-con man. Everything that's ever written about me in a newspaper starts off with famous con man Frank Abagnale. Not even retired or former famous con man Frank Abagnale. So those are things you just have to live with. So when you make a mistake, you have to live with those things the rest of your life. Yes?
Hello. Do you have a professional goal that you feel you still have to achieve?
I tried to write a lot of books. I tried to, for years and years, when I went outside the academy or the bureau to speak, it was always business to business, telling a bank how to protect their assets or telling a bank how not to be ripped off. I've spent the last few years speaking more directly to consumers and writing more directly to consumers. I've found that all crimes, whether they be cyber or otherwise, is simply a matter of educating the victim. If you educate someone and you say, here's your risks, and here's how you eliminate your risks, they're not going to fall prey to those crimes. As a country and as an American businesses and financial institutions and corporations, software companies, hardware companies, we do a horrible job of educating the consumer about how to protect themselves. So I can only reach so many people, so I do that through books and television appearances like this afternoon for a financial show, to simply try to tell people, this is a problem, but if I make you aware of it, when they come knocking on your door, you'll be totally enlightened about it. If I tell you not to do this on the Internet, then when it comes up, you'll go, oh, whoa, whoa, I already know about that. And I would just comment to you that there is no great master criminal sitting over in Beijing or Russia who is breaking into all of these secure systems. In every case I've been involved in involving a breach, it is not some master criminal. It is an employee of that company doing something they weren't supposed to be doing to begin with, opening the door for the criminal who's 1,000 miles away. Opened an email they shouldn't have opened, went onto a website they shouldn't have gone onto, even though they were instructed by the CIO of the company not to do that, they did it, and they caused the breach to occur. All they did is open the door for someone. There are not masterminds sitting around the world finding ways to get into systems. They're just waiting for someone to allow them into the system, and that's where they take over. Yes?
Thanks. I wanted to know if you could elaborate a little bit on a story that appears in the book. I think the story is that you're at a hot dog cart in New York City waiting to buy a hot dog, and a cop who recognizes your face from a photo or some sort of, you know, APB report says, "Hey, Frank," and you, like a great criminal, you turn around instinctively, and he knows that he has his man and arrests you. Is that...
Yeah, I escaped. I was convicted of the escape, given 3 years onto my sentence for escaping from federal custody. When the federal authorities brought me back to the United States, I escaped off the aircraft at Kennedy. And I was arrested just a few days later by a New York City police detective who just recognized me at a hot dog stand in Manhattan. So that's actually the way it happened. Yes, sir.
Thank you. As an ex-CBC student as well, beaten by the Irish, I just wanted to commiserate with you on that. What's your relationship with your brothers and sister? You did have siblings. What happened to them?
It's a great relationship. My youngest brother, unfortunately, died just a couple of years ago from a liver ailment. He was just 55 years old. I have a sister who's 65. She lives in southern New Jersey, and she just retired after 30 years as a nurse in a hospital. And I have an older brother who is a little older than me. He's about 67, and he lives up in Chester, New York, and he's retired. He was the director of a Catholic school up in New York. And I speak to them. My mother is still living. My mother is 86 years old. She lives up in Largemont, New York. I speak to her on the phone all the time, and New York is part of my territory, so I get to go to the city quite a lot, and I get to see her quite often. Any other questions? Yes.
In the movie, you are said to have bought some James Bond suits and a vehicle as well. Did that ever happen? And out of all the travels that you endured that were based inside the film, are there any stories or anything, one trip or thing that you did that stands out above any of them?
No, I think, you know, the whole James Bond thing was just because I like nice clothes and I like nice cars, and Steven Spielberg picked up on that. But there was no Austin Martin and there was no James Bond thing. That was just his way of entering to the story, that my like of, excuse me, of cars and clothes and things like that. I don't know. I think all the stories that, you know, have been told about through book and through movies and so on are pretty much all the things I did. Some of the things amazed me that I did. I didn't think they'd work. I just tried them. I was amazed by it. The benefit I think I had was not that I was by any means a genius or intelligent. What the greatest benefit I had is that I was an adolescent. So I had no fear of being caught. I had no fear of consequences. I didn't sit out in front of a bank and say, I'm about to go in with this check. If they say this to me, I'm going to say this. If they do this, I'm going to do that. I just went in the bank. And if I had, I believe truly, had I been a little older and started this at 21 or 22 years old, I would have rationalized everything to death and I would have never done it. I thought nothing of standing in front of the box at the airport because I thought it was an awesome idea, they'll never know, and I stood in front of it. Had I been a little older, I'd have said, oh no, they'll catch on, somebody will ask me something. I never let those things interfere with the things I did, and everything I did was just a spur of the moment. I just thought about it. When the FBI agent actually came in the hotel room and pulled his gun, I was in the bathroom. I wasn't sitting there thinking about, okay, I guess it's all over. I don't know what I'll say when I open the door. I basically walked out and gave it a shot. Hi, Secret Service Agent John Allen. I just said that. I didn't know, you know, I figured he'd say, are you crazy? But he didn't. And it went along and I got away with it. You know, so I think a lot of it was just because I was so young, I was willing to do those things. Any other question?
So today, whenever you go to the airport, do they ever look at your ID and just kind of chuckle a little bit?
You know, I'm very fortunate. I can go around security, but I go through security because I like to see what they're doing at TSA, so I purposely go through security. I'm very fortunate that as on the walk down here, they brought me a roundabout way because of the crowd, and I explained to the sweet young lady bringing me down, I said, I'm very fortunate that most people don't recognize me. They know my name, but they don't recognize me. And I find that pretty much the same. When I get on a plane, the flight attendants don't recognize me, but as soon as they get the flight itinerary and see that I'm on the passenger list, they recognize the name. But so I'm very fortunate in that way. Before I take any more questions, so I only have a few minutes, I wanted to leave you with a little advice about identity theft. It is a very serious crime. I've written 3 books on the subject. I wrote one back in 88 called Crimes of the Next Generation. I was talking about crimes in 88 from the year 2000 and beyond. So back in 88, no laptops, no computers, no emails, etc. And I wrote a chapter called Identity Theft, and I wrote about stealing identities. But in the old days, you had to go out and do all the research. So you read in the newspaper that someone had filed for bankruptcy, but now they've turned their company around and they're a multimillionaire today. So you went down to the bankruptcy court and you pulled out the fish line and fished out their bankruptcy, because on the bankruptcy filing was their date of birth, their social security number, their name, etc. So it was just a different way of doing it. Today, of course, it's all done by thousands of miles away on a laptop. We have 10 million children on Facebook. 7.5 million of them are under the age of 13. Last year, we had 1 million children bullied on Facebook. There is a software called Creeper, in which I know where your child is at every second of the day, as long as their cell phone is turned on. They don't have to be on it. As long as it's turned on and they have a Facebook page, I know where they are. So today there's a facial recognition program where I could take your picture in an airport, snap it on my iPhone, and in 7 seconds match it to your Facebook picture. Millions upon millions upon millions of Facebook pages and get a match. Now, if, for example, on your Facebook page you happen to tell me what state you were born in and you told me what date you were born on, then I'm 98% to ginging you, stealing your identity. So I tell a lot of young people, I have no problem with Facebook whatsoever. My 3 sons are on it. I'm not on it, but they're on it. I understand why young people like it. But if I'm going to put a picture on Facebook, you can rest assured it's not a frontal picture of me. It's a picture of me on a boat, me skiing down a mountain, me with a group of people in the background. If I'm going to talk on Facebook page, I'm not going to say the state I was born in, nor am I going to tell you the date of birth my date of birth on Facebook. So once again, it is a matter of educating young people how to use it properly. I don't know if you saw the other day a statistic that was put out by the Wall Street Journal, 4,300 companies surveyed, Fortune 1,000 companies, who said that 83% of them did look at Facebook pages before they hire someone, and 62% of them said they don't hire them if they see something on their Facebook page that's negative. That's unfortunate, but what's happening is if a 13-year-old gets on Facebook and says, I love the Nazis, I'm all about the Nazis, I'm a big Nazi fan. He's 13 years old, he really doesn't know what he's saying, but 6 years later he applies to the university and they say denied. He applies for a job, certainly a government job, he's denied because of what he said when he was 13 years old. It is unfortunate that that person's not sitting there looking at it saying, well, he was 13 years old when he said that. They only see the statement and the book closes. So I tell young people, be careful about the remarks you make on Facebook, because they'll come back to haunt you for years. Now, protecting your identity, I do three simple things. First, I do shred everything, because what you believe to be worthless is of great value to someone else. There are three shredders in the world: straight shredders, called ribbon shredders, crisscross shredders, and micro-cut shredders. The only shredder that actually shreds and you cannot put back together is a micro-cut shredder. All three shredders are the same price. Who manufactures the shredder is irrelevant. As long as on the box it says security, micro-cut, shredder. Now, what I've never understood, if you go to Office Depot, Staples, Office Max, they've taken all three shredders out of the box, put them on display, plugged them in, gave you a wrap of paper, and you walked up and went, shh, this cuts paper like this. Shh, this cuts paper like this. Shh, oh, this is confetti. What's to think about? Obviously, you want the one that's confetti. At the FBI laboratory in Quantico, Virginia, we can take back a bank statement on a crisscross shredder and put it together in less than 72 hours. We won't miss a decimal point off that, as we did in Enron, WorldCom, Tyco, Arthur Andersen. Even though the auditor shredded it, we put it back together again. Second, I helped develop Privacy Guard back in the early 1990s. It's a credit monitoring service I use. I stay with it today and keep it in its current pace so that it's always current and active. I'm proud to say today 10 of the 12 largest U.S. banks in assets use Privacy Guard to protect their customers. 10 of the 12, including American Express, protect their customers and cardholders through Privacy Guard. When I developed that system, there were only two important things to me. One, does it monitor all three credit bureaus 24/7? And two, does it notify the member in real time? Not by email, by a letter, every 90 days, but in real time as it is actually occurring so the victim can stop it before it goes through. Third, I don't write a lot of checks in today's environment, because if I go into CVS, Walgreens and write a check, on the check is my name and address and phone number, my bank's name and address, my account number at my bank, my routing number into my account, my signature on the signature card at my bank. Then the clerk at Walgreens wrote across the front my state driver's license number and my date of birth. We don't get that check back because we live in truncation, which means it's sitting in CVS's warehouse in Brooklyn. Anyone who sees that check can steal and debit my account from thousands of miles away. So I don't write a lot of checks. I don't use a debit card. Never possessed one, never used one. What I do is very simple. I like to remove from my life 99.9% of all risk. And I do that with the safest form of payment that exists on the face of the earth, and that is a credit card. Credit card. American Express, Visa, MasterCard, Discover. Every day of my life, I use that card. I go to the dry cleaner, credit card. Go to the grocery store, credit card. Get in the car, credit card. Go get gas, credit card. Get a car wash, credit card. Get on the plane, go on the boat. Every day, I spend the credit card company's money. My money sits in a money market account and earns interest. My money is never exposed. Only the credit card company's money is exposed. I will do everything in my power to make sure they don't get my number, but if they get my number and they charge $1 million on my credit card by federal law, I have zero liability. None. I have no liability. When you use a debit card, you're accessing your bank account. You're allowing someone to access your money. TJ Maxx, 48 million credit cards stolen. Debit cards, credit cards. Everyone who had a debit card waited 3 months to get their money back. Everyone who had a credit card got a new credit card the next day, FedEx store, in the mail 5 days later. When you use a credit card, you up your credit. You build your score. You get points. When you use a debit card, you do nothing. So consequently, young people come out of college, they've used their debit card, they can't rent an apartment, they can't buy a car because they have no credit. They only have a debit card. The greatest thing a parent can do for their child away at college is to give them a supplemental card off their credit card to allow them to build their own credit. So though that card bill comes to you and you are responsible for it, it has your child's name on it. And every time your child uses it and every month you pay it, it builds your child's credit score so that when they come out of college, they have scores in the 700s because you've taken care of that bill and you've taught them to build their own credit. So to me, still today, the only way I remove all my risk is through the use of a credit card and transfer the risk over to the credit card company. Now, I always tell young people, because I get to go out to a lot of colleges, that if you're not capable of paying the bill in full, which you should be because you have a job, every 2 weeks they pay you. You didn't pay for the dry cleaning. You didn't pay for the groceries. So now you should be able to write the check and pay the bill. But if you're going to only pay part of it and then pay part of it next month, you're going to get in debt. So you need a debit card and you need to use a debit card. If you control your credit, a credit card is the safest way. My website is just my name, abagnale.com. As you know, I sell no products. I provide no services. It is strictly an educational site. If you go to it, I write publications constantly about protecting your business from embezzlement, fraud, identity theft. You can go and download those things and print them out. But most of all, if you have a question, just send it to frank@abagnale.com. That's my email. It goes directly to me. It may take me a day to two to answer your question, but I will answer your question. And if I don't have an answer to it, I have access to people who will have an answer to it. It's been a pleasure. God bless you, and thanks for coming. Thank you.